Welcome to the seventh episode of the Will Work for Purpose podcast. Today we have something a little different. Today it's not quite an interview, it's more of a dialogue between me and a former guest, Alex Braun. Today we talk about the state of the world in general, but mainly we focus on the creative process and how creative types really do something special when they make things and how unfortunate it is when they decide to sell out and they sacrifice their art for money. So without further ado, here is the seventh episode of Will Work for Purpose. Hello and welcome to this episode of Will Work for Purpose. Today I'm joined with Alex Braun again. He was on in an episode that was on previously, and we had interviewed him about his work as an illustrator and art director and kind of what he does, how he got to where he's doing what he's doing, and kind of more of the details of his in particular work, or his work in particular. But today we're kind of doing something different. It's going to be kind of more of a back and forth dialogue. And for today, we've kind of chosen the question of questions pertaining to creation and the creative process. And so today we're just going to kind of begin with simple questions, and we'll inevitably get more complex from there. So yeah, I guess, Alex, why do you create? What makes you create things?
Hey, Adam. Thanks for having me.
Oh, yeah. That's a
yeah, I appreciate being on your show. I love Tweaking Optimism. Yeah, happy to chat. But yeah, with why do I create? Yeah, that's a fun place to start. I don't know. Thinking about it, I think to start, there's like the, because, you know, both of us being creators in general, there's, it all starts with this, with an idea that we have, like within ourselves, that we want to make tangible. And I think that's almost, it's almost like a power that creators have, like a tool that people can use to like make something real, whether that people can see it, listen to it, experience it. Like it is one of those magical things that it is about being a creator that not many people can do. Well, most people can do if they choose to, but you know, the ones that really get lost to it just love to do it for the sake of, you know, there's a satisfaction of, you know, when I draw a picture, be able to see it, and that way other people can see it. It's part of, you know, exposing yourself, like your internal thoughts and your feelings. You know, at the end of the day, like, people just want to be seen, they want to be heard. So there's something nice about being able to put that into a form that's not just me speaking to you, but me showing you like how I feel, sort of thing, without words. And for me, that's something very nice about art, is because, you know, unlike you, I am not good with my words and articulating things in the way that I want them to. So for me, pictures, it's always just much easier for me to say what it is I'm trying to say with drawings and colors and moods. So I don't know, do you feel the same way? You find that you create for the sake of being seen or having your ideas seen?
In some sense, I do value that, like, being seen portion of like the creative process. Like, I do, like, I write and I do publish what I write, you know? And so, like, I do like when people read it and respond to it more, like, I think more than being seen, I like when people interact with it, you know? And I guess that is a byproduct of being seen, because you have to see it to interact with it. But to me, it's like that taking, like, to me, there's almost no greater compliment you can pay to someone than to sit down and read what they wrote. It's a little bit different than the way art works, because art can be consumed in an instant. I could understand maybe like visual artists probably really appreciate when people take time and have an experience from their art, you know, not so much as like maybe the Instagram or social media experience, where it's sort of a double tap and scroll and you can interact with that media in simplicita, like very, very, very small amount. Like that interaction takes maybe 4 seconds. But I think any artist is flattered when someone interacts with their work and they spend 4 hours, 6 hours. Like if you write a book and someone reads your book, they've spent, you know, depending on the length of the book, they've spent anywhere between 1 to 20 hours with you. There are some books that I've read that have taken 30 hours, you know? And so it's like, I literally just spent 30 hours with just that person's ideas, just their internal monologue, essentially, you know, yeah. And say, and in some sense, like the visual portion, it's almost like just spending time with literally like the visual cortex of the artist, you know, like you're just spending time in their mind, seeing what they see essentially. Mm-hmm. And the longer you spend seeing what they see, you know, the more you can kind of gain their perspective or a new perspective, you know? And so like yeah. in my case, I personally, I do like expressing myself and being engaged with. I like the engagement. I like to be able to engage at a deeper level than what you can typically get in a general conversation. You know, if I'm interacting with someone and they're like, well, what do you think about this? And it's like, well, we can talk for a long time and I'm glad to do that. But most people don't have 6 hours to talk about, you know, specific issues or specific ideas or concepts. And so some ways writing a, you know, a 3,000 word blog post and having that on hand, like these are my views on God, sex, love, morality, et cetera. And even 3,000 words, those are insufficient because those are ideas that we've been dealing with for since human history began, you know. Mm-hmm. And so for me, like the value of creating or the sort of the drive I have to create is in that expression of ideas and then in the expression of those ideas, hopefully receiving feedback, because the feedback also helps me refine my ideas in their expression, you know? So like if I'm interacting with someone and they say, you're wrong here, 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 and here, and this is why, and they provide reasonable arguments and they're able to kind of defend their position and really push me to new depths of understanding, then I gained all the world for exposing them to what I created, you know? And likewise, hopefully they too can gain some perspective or some deeper understanding or some further insights. Right. Do you find, I don't know if there's anything there that you kind of felt you wanted to respond to or you that resonated with you or.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, there's two things. Like one of them you said, which it's, what's really nice and the real compliment is when people take time to, you know, read your book, look at your art or read your article, because it's this very humanistic feeling that we like is to be heard as people. So it's like just as much as anyone likes when their significant other, you know, takes some time to listen to them, or, you know, if you have a grievance and you sit down with that person, and you know, you just talk and they just absorb and listen. Like it's a very empathetic human response to like listen to that person and, you know, either reply back with your own thoughts or just help them to feel validated in what it is that they're thinking. So I think that's a huge part of it, is just like wanting to be heard, wanting to be acknowledged. And the second part where you talked about is like the response. That's also like just a very like real human experience that we all want to do, you know, and affecting the people around us is that domino effect. Like I want to be able to express someone that either makes someone feel like their own ideas are validated or that they're not alone. Just as people, it's like, it's, I would go to say it's what we're created to do, is to, you know, interact with all these people around us and just start with those ideas to create them, to get someone else to respond. So yeah, I agree with what you said as far as the, you know, the getting the feedback from someone is very nice. And just the feeling of someone saying like, hey, I went and looked at your work. Like I thought it was amazing. Like it really inspired and encouraged me. Like that's one of the very simple pleasures of creating and the creative process. So yeah, that's, I agree with you there.
Yeah, and I think that you kind of touched on something about the creation process, the creative process being sort of somewhat inherently human in that sense. I think you're totally spot on there in the sense that I think creation and the expression of ideas, thoughts through creative methods is explicitly human in the sense that we're relational beings, you know, like in the creative process in part relies on those relational interactions, you know, being heard is a very important part of the creative process because very few people can create in a vacuum. Now, some people can, but even so, most people create with the hopes of being understood or at least being seen or heard, you know, yeah. I think
If I may ask you a question, do you feel that people can know you more by reading what you write or by having a conversation with you in person?
Yeah, I think if you read, like, there are people who I can only know through their writings. And in some sense, that's, you know, that in one ways, that's a tragedy. In other ways, that's pretty great because you get to meet people who have long been dead. But in other ways, like, you don't get the full picture of who that person was. I think you can get a good understanding of me if you read everything that I've written or, you know, that kind of thing, or everything that I've created. But in another sense, you won't know me at all, because there are a lot of things that feed in to who I am as an individual that I don't necessarily portray on paper. You know, like, you wouldn't be able to get my physical presence, for instance. You know, you wouldn't be able to understand, like, there's sort of a different feeling than when you're reading something as opposed to when you're face to face with that person. You know, there are people who, you know, I think a good and lesser example of this would be text messaging. You can message with somebody for a long period of time, and then frequently you'll get in a room with that person and they'll be completely different than the way they portrayed themselves online. Now, in one sense, their written self might be truer than their in-person self, because, like, in my case, I have social anxiety. And so for me, I clam up in person, whereas with the screen in between or some pieces of paper to convey thoughts, like, I can be a lot more precise in my language. I can be more bold, direct, assertive. I can portray a lot more character traits that sometimes are lost due to the anxiety of interacting with people in person.
So you're a lot more confident.
Right. Yeah. Right. And so in some sense, I think your art, at least in my case, it can be, it can help you understand a certain portion of who I am. Like, you can understand the types of things I like to read, watch, listen, the types of people who I look up to. You can kind of glean a lot of that. But, like, as far as, like, my personality, my affect, my mood, you know, the way I carry myself, my physical appearance, things like that, a lot of that can be lost in translation. What about you? How do you feel you're presented in your artwork? Do you think that people, if they were to look through your portfolio, they'd be like, oh, I can kind of understand who this Alex Braun guy is?
Yeah, that's something I've been asking myself now. Because, yeah, like, you know, with what you're saying, like, there's, you feel a lot more comfortable behind a keyboard, you know, when you're writing out your thoughts. And, you know, maybe that's part of the difference between, like, creators and, you know, I just know a lot of creators who have social anxiety. Like, they just don't like something about being in front of people, incites, you know, someone to perform a certain way or to, you know, figure out how to navigate through the conversation. To whereas, like, when I sit in front of a piece of paper with a pencil, like, I it's something I'm confident in. It's like, I know how to express this idea or this image within this piece of art. But then, you know, as far as me personally, like, if my art can convey exactly who I am, I'm not quite sure I would say yes, because, you know, there's obviously, like, I draw a lot of things that I'm a fan of that really, strike a chord with, like, something I love or where my passion is, with storytelling. And I can really pour myself out into a story as far as, like, my own ideas. And, you know, just some things that I've been asking myself and questioning. So there's, like, it's a little divided for me because, you know, sometimes I can come through with who I am, like, stories. They just talk about things that I am in agreeance with, but within stories, you know, you're not going to get, my personality. You're not going to, you know, see, my quirkiness or my dry humor or anything like that. So it's kind of hard to tell, because, like, that's a big part of me, but then also, you know, what these drawings convey is a really big part of me. So yeah, it's tough to incite personality into work. And, you know, personality is very much something that incites people to be in your presence. Like, you know, when I'm talking to you, like, would I rather read what you're writing or, you know, have a conversation with you as a friend? You know, and most times, like, I like to do both. I'd rather, like, talk to you in person a lot, but then, you know, read your articles and, you know, your writing for the sake of, like, understanding more about you. But, yeah, it's hard to have, like, I guess it's different depending on relationships, you know, of like, what's the difference between me, if I'm going to Adam Mosley's work, and am I going to see his work, or because he's a good friend, you know? And mm-hmm. and there's two sides of that, to where, you know, some people just know you as the writer, whereas other people know you as husband, son, brother, friend, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do agree with you there. Like, you can actualize different parts of your personality given certain contexts. So like, you know, I may be perceived differently to my mom, to my sisters, to my wife, to my friends. Like, each of those may have a different perception of who I am. Mm-hmm. Likewise, those people who only watch podcasts or only read my blog posts or articles, or, you know, are those people who I only interact with at work. Like, there's definitely different parts of me that are actualized in each of those instances. And like, there's something to be said there too, because some people like, and that's to bring in the question of integrity, which is something that most people don't talk about. I've never heard any modern person talk about maintaining integrity. And integrity is that being the same no matter who you're with, in that sense. And mm-hmm. and I would say that I am the same no matter who I'm with, but I'm actualizing different parts of that sameness, you know, like when I'm with my coworkers, or maybe actualizing more of my you know, politically correct or polite side, or, you know, with my friends, I may be actualizing more of my humor. I'm there, you know, or with my sisters, I may be actualizing more of, like, you know, I don't know, like, it may be a combination of like humor plus, you know, affection plus whatever, you know, like, so there are different characteristics that are accentuated given certain contexts. It's sort of like when you're making food, certain spices bring out the taste of that food more in certain ways, or focus. It allows you to taste more of one thing in something. You know, for instance, like if you add more salt to a steak, you get more of a meaty flavor. You taste more beef than if you were to have left it unsalted, you know? And right. So like, there are a lot of things like that, you know, like, so like, for instance, if like the salt of friendship is applied to me, you get more of my, you know, label this here, you get more debate, dialogue, conversation, you know, humor, you know, that kind of stuff.
Right.
You know, whereas if you applied a different spice, maybe the spice of wife or of husband, or the spice of son, like, you get different flavors, you know, given mm-hmm. that context. And like, and so, but it's definitely important to be the same no matter who you're with, whether it's in your writing or in person, you know? So like, I would never want my writing to be so divorced from who I am as a person that if you were to read it, you would get no understanding of who I am. Likewise, I'm sure you would agree, like, you don't want your art to be so different from you that no one would even believe it was you who was making that art, you know? Yeah. And then in some sense, like, because then all of a sudden you might run into like creating this persona, and maybe you want to create a persona. A lot of people, you know, would create pen names and would like write in such a way that they would carry themselves in one way and write in another way. I can think of like in the mid centuries, like the, you know, the 12th, 13th, 14th, 15th centuries or whatever, there was this prevailing opinion, which was indoors as you please, outside as custom dictates. And so that led to people writing books under surnames and pen names, books that had to be so different from themselves. Like, they wrote and criticized ideas, but they would never hold those beliefs to anybody that would know them, basically, or could know them, you know, so that those ideas couldn't be tied to them and they would be executed or whatever horrible thing would happen to them back then, you know? And so like, I do agree. Like, I would say that there is a time and place for divorcing your identity from your work, but for the most part, at least right now, in modern times, unless you're living in some horrible circumstances, anyone living in America, Canada, England, Australia, like kind of these westernized societies, there's really no severe threat of allowing your personality to be portrayed in your work. Mm-hmm. Do you ever feel that you are put, like, because I can't think of some things where I have written differently than I am. And that's where I'm trying to like, maybe apply a new style to my writing or something like that. I've kind of like parroted someone else's style. Like, for instance, like in my, I have a series called Beelzebub Blurbs, and they're a bit like Screwtape letters, admittedly, you know, they're letters from devils, you know? And so mm-hmm. the style is some sort of, like, it's becoming more of my own the more I do of them, but ultimately it's not my own style. It's it was derived from C.S. Lewis.
Right.
Do you ever do that? Do you ever like adopt another style or create a persona or anything like that?
Yeah, absolutely. And like to your point of with your Beelzebub blurbs, you know, it's even though that is pulled from a different context, it's still something that is authentically you because, you know, you personally really appreciate the Screwtape letters. So your appreciation for that is very authentic. Therefore, you know, absorb that into your own personality in writing those blurbs. So I think like this just got my mind thinking too, as being an artist, it's very much the difference between doing personal work and client work. You know, because I think most artists would agree that client work is not as enjoyable as personal work because you're not doing something based off of your excitement for it. You're doing something based off of someone else asking for it. And then, you know, when you do that, it's like, oh, I'm, you know, at this point, I'm just using my understanding of shapes and colors and lines in order to create this artwork. Whereas when I do something personal, like those things are all very secondary to the main story that I'm trying to tell. Which, you know, if it's for someone else, then I'm telling their story and then I don't have as much of an attachment to it. Therefore, there's just a difference that I notice as far as like my own response and other people's response to it. So, yeah.
Go ahead.
No, you go.
Would you consider it creation still if you're doing it for someone else? Or do you think that the creative process like necessitates your personal involvement mm-hmm. with the project?
Yeah, that's a good question because then it gets to a point where it's just muscle memory, you know. It'd be the same if I asked you to write me an article on how good toothpaste is for you. You know, it's like something that you can agree with, but at that point you wouldn't really be talking as much about your own experience with toothpaste. You could, but you know, you wouldn't really be excited about it. So then it just turns into muscle memory, you know, then it's just you typing the words and the sentences and constructing the paragraphs in the way that you know how. Same that when I do client work, it's like, oh, then I'm just exercising these muscles and doing like the thing that I know how to do. So it's very, very separating between like the skill and the appreciation for creating something like visual or just illustration. So yeah,
in that sense, like creation is sort of necessitates this sort of like transcendent quality or something. There's something more to it than just the material methods being used, you know.
Right.
Is that something like do you feel that's probably true, that there is some sort of transcendent quality to it, or there's something more than the matter involved in the creative process that makes something truly creative or something that we would call creative?
Yeah, absolutely. It's, you know, it's the difference between objective and subjective art. You know, while both of them are very hard to define of what good art is. You know, I think that's the separation, and it's very vast because it's the difference between, drawing an apple and to the difference being like, what is it about my human existence that makes me understand this apple sort of thing? So it becomes very wide of, you know, trying to figure out like, what is it that me as a person, like, why am I inspired to, put something onto this page? And like, what is my motivation to do that? So, and I'm sure you probably say the same, like, you know, if you were asked to write something informative rather than something that is for you and about you, there'd be quite a difference there.
Yeah, I agree. Like there's something different about writing something that I want to write or that I'm inspired to write, and then writing something to sell something or make money, or, you know, I edit textbooks, you know, for a living. And so like, I don't, it's the same process as writing, but I'm editing a textbook, you know? Mm-hmm. And so it's like, you know, I don't get the same, transcendent joy that I get from writing like about some experience I had or some thought I have or some philosophical concept or something like that. Mm-hmm. Like those things that really spark in me that light that fuel that I feel I'm actualizing my purpose, or I'm living out my purpose or calling, or living up to what I'm meant to do when I'm writing on those things. Whereas when I'm just using the skills of writing, it's less, you know, it's less meaningful. It's less impactful. It's less joyful in some senses, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's similar to what we talked about in the last video of, you know, the art as propaganda. You know, it's propaganda in general, and art is very much just a tool to get you to either buy into a product or an idea, pretty much. Whereas like creating something personal, you're like, what would you say you're trying to, in a way, personal art is also trying to sell people something, but in a different way. So what would you say that you're trying to sell people whenever you are writing a new article or posting a new video? Like you're trying to, obviously we're doing this for the sake of people to see it, you know? Right. So what is it that you want people to buy whenever you write personal things?
See, that's a good question, because in some sense, like I almost want them to just, I don't know. I see that buying is such a hard way for me to phrase it, you know, like, because I was nearly about to say, I want them to buy me, essentially. I want them to buy my ideas, my personality, my writing style. I want them to buy all of that. But in some sense, I think what I'm really selling is an idea or a new way of looking at something. Right. And like, and the buying in some sense for me is not necessarily the transaction of funds, but the adherence to the properties taught therein. So it's something like, for instance, the best way I can kind of conceptualize it is like Plato said, show me the way a man lives and I'll show you his philosophy. Okay, so he's not saying, you know, I don't want to hear what he says. I don't hear what he thinks. I don't want to hear how he, whatever. I want to see how he lives. I want to see what things he does in his life. And I'll tell you whether he's a virtue ethicist or deontologist or insert ethical theory here, insert metaphysical theory here, insert whatever, you know, whatever philosophical concept here, I'll be able to tell you what of those things he believes in by the way he acts them out. So it's the acting out of a belief that is the sort of exception of the belief, you know. It very matters very little what you think and more about what you do. And so like, for instance, if I wrote a piece saying, you know, everyone should walk leading with the right foot, the people who I would consider to have bought what I've sold are the people who start to walk leading with that foot that I specify, you know, whether it's right or left, you know, like if I go out in society and see, you know, a room full of 200 people who read my article and I see 50 people doing what I said. Now, of course they could have already been doing it before I wrote it. But let's say, for instance, none of them, we know for a fact, all of them were leading with their left foot first. And after my article about leading with your right foot first, 50 of those 200 people are leading with their right foot. And let's say my article had a paywall behind it and that cost $3. I would consider, though everyone bought the article and paid $3 for it, I would consider those who truly bought it or bought into it, rather, to be the 50 people leading with their right foot. So in some sense, I guess I'm selling the idea, but you know, like it's very closely entangled. You know, I'm not that concerned with the distribution of funds. I wouldn't write if I cared about how much money I made, because I make very, very little from writing, you know? So it's like one of those things where it's like, I write more about to sell ideas rather than to sell ideas for the change in behavior and thinking rather than to sell words for money. You know,
right. So with that example of, you know, you're writing this article saying, hey, here's why you should lead with your right foot rather than your left. Mm-hmm. So what's your what would be your motivation to, like, why do you care what foot people would lead with, you know?
Yeah. So, I mean,
like more the conceptual question.
Yeah. I mean, the reason I might say lead with your right foot, you know, is because maybe I find it to be, more virtuous, you know. I'm a virtue ethicist, so that means like I'm more concerned with someone being good rather than like in like doing like, and in so being good you will necessitate good things, like doing good things, you know, like if you're trying to be modest you will do modest things, right? And so I'm more concerned with like the ethical impact of my ideas. You know, like I want to create a more ethical society, or a society which is more virtuous. And that's like a super weird to say in modern times. Most people are not concerned with virtue. Most people are concerned with pleasure and the pursuit of pleasure. And that's why we say things like the pursuit of happiness, or, you know, finding your best life, or things like that. Like those things, like while some of those principles may be good, like finding your best life or trying to do what's happy. Although I don't think happiness is something we should pursue, because I don't think you can pursue it. I think the pursuit of it nullifies the pursuit of it. So like if you're chasing it, it's more like a dog chasing its tail. You never get it. And if you do get it, it only hurts you. Where like, I think something that's more apt or more meaningful to do is this pursuit of joy. And joy, I'm using with a metaphysical distinction of something that fulfills you and you find meaningful. So this idea of the pursuit of virtue is sort of abstract, or sort of like people don't really understand what that means. People say, oh, be a good person, do good things. It's like, well, what does that even mean? You know, in reality, it means living a virtuous life. Another way of putting it is like to imitate the transcendent good, you know? And so the transcendent good is classically defined as God, that which is the goodness of good, which is in the Hebrew scriptures defined as the Holy of Holies. That is like the goodness that is so good that it burns away any badness. Right. And so the imitation of that is what I'm concerned with. And so my writings precipitate that, you know? So my idea, like me wanting to create a more virtuous society, a society that's more empathic, more compassionate, more loving, more kind, more caring, more charitable, all those attributes I want to see more of in society, because I think that ultimately improves the society. Right. And to improve society is a precipitation of me attempting to be a virtuous person.
Right. So with that statement, like, you know, you're incentivizing someone to lead with their right foot, because leading with their right foot ultimately will be good for them. Like, say in this world where, you know, when you step with your right foot, like you get a little healthier every 10 seconds or something.
Right.
So at the end of the day, like your motive is to, you know, incite more joy into people by showing them that, hey, you know, if you lead with your right foot, your life's going to be better. But, you know, there's going to be a lot of people who would be like, no, I've just always known my left foot. So I'm just going to lead with that one. And, you know, thinking about that, it's got me thinking to kind of the sort of corruption of creation, whether it also be the corruption of virtues, to where, you know, as C.S. Lewis talks about, like, you know, it's not quite a duality of good and evil, but it's evil being a corruption of that which is good. So within like our time now, it's, here's a whole campaign of, you know, people preaching that you should start walking with your right foot, because you're going to live a better life. And then you start getting these people who agree with that, but want to profit off of it. So they're like, all right, hey, here's a special shoe that'll help you to even, get an even better step with your right foot. And then from there, it's like, oh, here's an even better shoe from that. Like, then let's start, turning this into a direction of consuming, you know, and using this virtue for our gain, to where suddenly the virtue is lost, to where people start forgetting why they're even starting to walk with their right foot, because now they're so much more concerned with how their right foot looks rather than what it's doing for it. So just something I started thinking about as far as like how creating and the joy of creating can go down this sort of negative route, to where I think Instagram or social media can be the same thing with creating, to where, you know, I know I've struggled with this before, where, you know, my motivation to start drawing is like, oh, I want to share some ideas. And, you know, I've drawn some things that I think are really fun, things that excite me. And I want to share the world so that we can share in our enjoyment of this together. But then it can become a thing of like, oh, then I get so concerned with the amount of people that are looking at my art, that I'm just, that becomes the focus instead of the joy itself. And, you know, I think a lot of people struggle with this, is trying to get such a big following to where they forget, like, why do I have this following in the first place? You know, seeking more of the validation for your art over, you know, like seeking that over your own enjoyment of the creative process. So I don't know about you, but I know I struggle with that a lot of like wanting to create something that gets a lot of attention rather than creating something for just the sake of enjoyment. Did you also struggle with that in your own writings?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Like there are things, you know, some of the things that get the most views are political pieces, you know, and I cannot bear to write something that's explicitly political, you know, slurring some politician or going after some policy or whatever. Like I can't bring myself to do it, you know? And so in some sense, like just, I literally, if I were to sit down and try and write a piece for a current trend, you know, I saw something trending even about the unfortunate death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Is that right? Ruth Bader Ginsburg. She was a Supreme Court justice. Yeah. And she just died yesterday. And there, you know, that's got hundreds of thousands of people tweeting, people interacting with that idea. I couldn't bring myself to write a piece on that, even though I could potentially get a few thousand hits or, you know, whatever. Like there are certain things that I can't bring myself to do. Now, where I do like falter is like another thing that I can do and have done and don't like doing, but does earn views is like, just going after people, you know, like you can like see stuff on, like most things I see on social media, I think are wrong fundamentally, most things. And so I could potentially comment on everything and I could argue with every post and I could, discredit every person's views and I could develop robust arguments and sort of attack any person I so choose online. And sometimes I get into arguments I probably don't need to get into online. And like, those are formats, the online format, though I do think it's important to argue with some people online. I don't think it's important to argue with every person online, though the arguments earn lots of views. I debated this guy on Twitter. I was in a debate with this guy on Twitter who has loads. He has, you know, 300,000 YouTube subscribers and 40,000 Twitter followers or whatever. And we were debating about these two philosophical principles, which he just couldn't grasp for some reason. And it was back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And it was super, super popular. It had several hundred tweets, lots of likes, you know, et cetera. But really it was not a productive use of my time. It wasn't beneficial in any way other than getting me some followers and some retweets and some likes and whatnot. Right. And so like, that threat is always there. And I would say that is the pressure that vice places on virtue or the corruption of virtue, right? So the desire to create something good and edifying for society is virtuous. Mm-hmm. The vice is that consumerism that presses in on it and says, now monetize it and make as much money as you possibly can from it.
Yeah, absolutely. It's very much like a Frodo in the ring situation where, you know, it's like, here's the source of this power. And, you know, Frodo feels tempted to keep the power for himself. And like, as creators, there's always those sources that we can go to for power, you know, if we want to get more of a following and to be seen by more people. There's like those secret rooms that are locked up, but we know that we can go in there if we want that certain thing that we desire. You know, for you, it's writing on politics or stirring up drama to get people to see more of your work. And for me, you know, with artists, it's, you know, either jumping on it, not as extreme, but, you know, jumping on the bandwagon of like doing fan art for something or unfortunately, like exploiting sexuality within illustrations is definitely a huge thing that, like, you know, a lot of artists are known for doing, and it obviously gets them a lot of attention and following. So there's definitely a lot of roads that people can go to change what it is that they're creating in order to get something else. And, you know, something that's different from the means of creating in the first place, like what we talked about with, which is the, you know, the sharing of those virtues, whether it is sharing and trying to help someone live a better life, or creating something for the sake of getting people to enjoy it together. There's always that like little nag in the corner that, you know, it's like, oh, I can entertain that and it'll give me what I want, but then my motives will be soiled by it.
Do you ever write something or draw something and you're like, I did this because I wanted to get views? And do you ever not share it or take it down because you were unhappy with yourself in creating something like that?
I've had that a lot. There have been some that I took down just for the sake of like, oh, that didn't really resonate. Like that was just kind of some clickbait, you know, mm-hmm. for artists. It's like I look at those things and I feel a little sad because it's like I don't really connect with this. Like I look at it and it's like it's cool that it'll bring, you know, someone else joy by looking at it, but for me it's like I just see a hollow motive, you know. It's a little empty and, you know, it doesn't have that that meat of personality and intention to it, so it makes me a little sad. And I think there's some people who can, you know, sniff that out in other people's work of like, you know, this is, I see you're saying a lot of really big words, but, you know, what's your point here? Mm-hmm. And I think that's very prevalent in art. It's like, oh, I see you know, I can't really think of an example right now, but it's like, oh, I see you did this elaborate piece just to kind of get some follows. But you know, it doesn't really excite me. You know, you got all the right pieces, and you know, this is a big movie thing too, of like just how marketing has made its way into movies. It's like, oh, we just got all these pieces. We got the cute character, we got the bad guy, the good guy, we got diversity, we have inclusion, and you know, these ideas that a lot of people should agree with. So obviously this is the making of a good movie, and then they release it and then everyone hates it. You know, I think that's a big means within Hollywood right now, unfortunately. But that's like, that's the difference there. It's the difference between, you know, using math and creation versus using that X factor, whatever that is, of, you know, wanting to tell a good story for the sake of telling a good story and being human. You know, I think there's like a lot of stories out there that just take the human part out. You know, they just want to say, tell a story that is agreeable to the masses rather than telling a story that is authentic and vulnerable. You know, I think at the end of the day, it's just people not wanting to take risks.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with a lot of what you said there. I think it's funny to see that in Hollywood, and I really like to see movies like that flop. Personally, it just makes me feel I just enjoy that because what they essentially do is exactly what you're saying. Is they say, okay, what type of people watch movies? Okay, well, there's this group, this group, this group. There's the 18 to 19 or the 18 to 25 year olds that are in college, graduating college. They're the 30 to 40 people with small children. They're the social justice types. They're the apolitical types. Or, you know, there are these all these different types. They get all their demographics, and then they say, okay, we're going to take a bit of you, 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 and then at the end they have this patchwork monster of pandering, essentially. They create this horrible pardon my language, but the bastardization of any creative process, and they put it out there for everybody to watch and see, and it's just grotesque and almost sometimes can make you feel ill because it's just so gross the way it looks, you know, like you can see the stitches where they patched everything together.
It can make you feel ill from having having been drawn by it in the first place, you know. If, like a movie like that, if you feel really excited for it and then afterwards, you know, that's the result, you feel bad about yourself from, you know, even being excited about it.
Right. You're like, oh my gosh, I was played essentially by the advertisers. You know, like it's one of those things.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, you keep going.
I was going to say, it's like the culmination of like, if an algorithm were to write a movie, you know, like I think that's essentially it. It's like just this corporate powerhouse picking all these pieces and saying, this is the formula, like we got it figured out, but like what are we missing? And then it's like, oh, you're missing the heart. Like, you know, it's got a brain, it's got arms, it's got legs, but yeah, this thing is still a robot.
It's right, It's being run by machines. It's the machine man with the machine mind with, you know, there's nothing real. It's an artificial abstraction that it was fabricated to make money at the expense of other people's time.
I was going to say what I love about, you know, it's that X factor within, you know, a lot of popular stories now is that empathy for the human experience, you know, like at the end of the day, like I think that's what a lot of people really love. And like, maybe even don't know that they do love about a good movie is that it tells something that I can resonate with, you know. I cannot resonate with a Mary Sue character because I often lose. Like, there's a lot of things in life that I am terrible at. A lot of things that I try to do, don't fail to keep up with. But it's a matter of always rising up to the challenge. And that's prevalent just about in every human being at the moment. You know, it's that idea that like we are authentically like very flawed people, and I cannot resonate with someone who gets it right every time.
Right. And that's like, I wrote down a little note here that juxtaposed the pandering creative product, like the thing that is patchworked together from many different things and ultimately pleases nobody. There's that juxtaposed with the divine creative piece, you know, the piece that was created using the attributes most commonly attributed to God himself, you know. Original creation, goodness, you know, love, mercy, kindness, charity, all these things, that those attributes are the portrayal of virtues or the employment of virtue in the creative process creates something that people, that's timeless, that people will read forever. You know, the thing that's made out of your own creative process, not so that it will sell millions of copies, but because it's an outflowing of that transcendence, we'll call it, for secular people is something that's what makes good art, you know? And on a side note, do you have something that you want to say to that? If not, I had something that I wanted to share.
Yeah, go ahead.
This is a quote from Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who was basically helped bring down the wall in Russia. He was writing in Stalinist Lenin times, and he wrote this book called The Gulag Archipelago, which is essentially like, he won a Nobel Prize in literature for it, basically for his moral force and ferocity, which he stood against the Stalinist regime in Russia. And but he had this to say about advertisements, which is very apropos, it fits in very well in America, I think. And so I just want to share it here. Freedom to fill people's minds, mailboxes, eyes, and ears with commercial rubbish against their will, television programs that are impossible to watch with a sense of coherence, freedom to force information on people, taking no account of their right not to accept it or their right to peace of mind, freedom to spit in the eyes and souls of passerbys with advertisements. And it's like, man, I do my best to avoid advertisements. Like I install ad blocker. I recommend everybody installs ad blocker. In some senses, I understand advertising is a necessary evil for creators to be paid. But advertisements ultimately, like in some sense right now, they're white noise. Like I don't even recognize them when I see them. But, you know, like they're everywhere. They're unavoidable. It's like, and that's in one sense what they are. They used to not be so bad before when you only had a newspaper, but now, you know, with your cell phone, the interactive newspaper, you can get fed advertisements, you know, at a billion times the rate. And it's like a $1 trillion industry almost, or something like that. Like everybody runs ads. Everyone runs ads. Even the bloody government runs advertisements. You know, it's like, you think I could know about the government without an advertisement popping up in my face, you know?
Like on a similar note to that of like just the advertising of like those good and virtuous things, like that's that's very, it's so common. And you know, that's just advertise, like just what this whole this game has become of, you know, constantly selling and consumerism is, you know, it's always the matter of finding something that is good and exploiting it to the highest degree. You know, it's like, have you had those moments where you find an author or like an artist or a musician or something, and it's like they have very, very little following or something, and then, but you really appreciate their work and you're like, wow, I found a gem here. You know, like, this is something that I'm surprised not more people are following this person. And then, you know, later on, a bunch of people do start following and they start to get the clout and get really, really popular. Then you maybe disconnect from it a little bit, because then it turns into yeah. this, you know, piece of consumerism where, you know, this artist has been taken and then they've been exalted to the highest extent. And now it's like, oh, now it's just this tool to appease to the masses pretty much, and just sell to however many people it can. Whereas at first it was like, man, this was something that felt special because it felt like it was being sold to me personally, you know? And that's when, like, you know, these things become really big, then they just have to work at pleasing as many people as possible. And the more you please many people, the, you know, the more it starts to stray from pleasing you personally. So,
sorry, go ahead. That's exactly right. Yeah, no, I mean, I would just add on to that, you know, whenever something gets picked up and becomes big like that and starts making millions of dollars or so, you know, whatever, and becomes corporatized, you know, I think whenever anything becomes corporatized, it necessarily loses its metaphysical or transcendent value. Like, it loses all those like savory divine components, you know, because it has to pander to so many people, and it has to act within certain social norms and governmental guidelines. You know, you can't include certain language or, right, you know, say certain things or think certain things in some cases, or express certain sentiments, or else, you know, we're going to take it all away from you. Mm-hmm. We're going to take all your money. We're going to take all your clout. We're going to take all your following, all your pages, everything, your ability to talk in front of people. We're going to deplatform you. It's all gone, man. Like, if you mess up, your everything is gone. Everything you thought you were working for, that's snapped away, you know? And like, there's that old cliche, which is like, the man who has nothing to lose is the person you kind of should be afraid of. He's the most scary person in the room. And it's like, and the flip side of that is the person who has everything to lose, you don't have to worry about it at all. You don't have to worry about them saying anything important because they have everything to lose. They won't risk it, you know? So like, they won't say anything important. They won't say what needs to be said. They won't make the types of points that need to be made. They won't share the type of art that needs to be shared because they have everything to lose. They can't be bold, courageous. They can't, none of those things are true of anyone who is popular. I would dare someone to find me or share with me someone who has 50 million, you know, who makes more than $1 million in the public eye, who says things that need to be said. There may be one or two in living today, you know, but most of the people who said what needed to be said lived in a time where they couldn't accumulate clout and wealth in the way that they can now. And in a lot of ways, modernization of the world has anesthetized it or immunized it against productive, coherent, edifying thoughts, opinions, views, art. Like, I struggle to believe that art in the way that it's understood popularly, like Billboard Top 100, New York Times bestsellers, the way that, I don't know if there's a similar rating system for visual art. Maybe it's like the box office for movies, and I don't know if there's something for images that's equivalent, but I don't think any of the art that will make it there will be sharing anything edifying, especially as the world sort of spirals down the trail that it's going right now, which is the path of vice rather than virtue. We had talked a bit about convincing people to walk with their right foot. Well, in a world of people who, in a world that is tailored to walking on your left foot, it's almost impossible to walk on your right foot. That is to say, in a world that's tailored to vice and moral degradation, it's impossible to walk on the right foot, to walk upright, to be virtuous, to be good, to imitate the transcendent good, to imitate God, Christ. Those things are becoming increasingly impossible in a world that is made for people who walk on leading with their left foot, who yeah. walk in vice.
It's a world that from being infants, we've been trained to start with our left foot, sort of thing. So to jump on the right, like the reason it's so hard for people to accept is because suddenly you're having to unlearn everything that is within, you know, your nature and things that you've grown up to understand. You've things that have made you comfortable, you know, and you know, they like what is comfort now to the people who walk with their left foot? It's their comfort is in money. It's in, you know, making sure they're sustained with their life walking in on their left foot. It's very hard to unlearn, which is why people aren't as accepting for it.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that the biggest thing right now is moral appeasement. People have conscience. They have a conscience. You can feel what is wrong. Now, the thing about a conscience is that it can be educated or washed out of you in a sense, you know? And so that's what people are further and further trying to do. They're trying to normalize things. The most notably right now is that horrible, horrible, horrible Netflix movie that exploits children, right? And I don't even need to say the name for you to know what it is. Cuties, right? That is to attempt to normalize and appease the consciousness of whoever partakes in that type of behavior. And it's a steady degradation. Like you erode, and it's not a fallacy or slippery slope. It's not fallacious to think that certain ideas lead to other ideas. And so like the erosion of morals in certain areas necessarily leads to other areas of erosion, you know? So like the sexual instinct has been eroded now for 100 years. Now, to be fair, it's gone wrong. It's been wrong for the entirety of human existence. There's been, that particular instinct is one of the most corrupt. However, it's becoming not only, at least there used to be taboos against the corruption of it. And now, now you're finding that, I think in California, I heard that there's a law that's passed that you can have consensual intercourse with someone provided they're no more than 10 years younger than you. And I don't know that there's a stop loss on that. So I don't know that there's some like, and I may be wrong and someone may prove me wrong, but even the fact that there's a law that says something like 10 years younger than you is like, it shows you where we've gone wrong, you know? If you have any ideas on that or thoughts.
Just that like they have to address it is the concern in itself already. Like it's, it's just sad. Like that this is the rhythm of the world by now, you know, it's just the slowly but steadily exploiting anything that they can. If it then turns into like, oh, here's a way that we can get money from criminals, like they'll find it, you know, it's like, oh, you know, even, you know, the even terrorists have money or something. So let's start to, advertise to them, like not that anyone would, but it's just one of those steadily pursuing sort of features of, you know, for the sake of gain, there's becoming very little limitations. And, you know, like the more someone wants to grow in that, they'll just keep cutting down, chopping down, knocking down those walls for whatever it is they want. So, it's terribly sad, but it's sort of a weird... It creates for like a weird middle ground, you know, like where is like the fine line? Like, where is that middle ground of, you know, creating something and, you know, where you, it's like, give me neither riches nor poverty sort of instance.
Right.
Like, it's such a balance in between, you know, don't want to exploit too much, but also still want to be seen, but also don't want to, you know, just be neglected by everyone.
Right. And so, that's a good point. I think there are two ways to sort of accumulate wealth, right? So there is, you can, and maybe accumulate is the wrong word, but you can get more of it. You can get more money, more clout, more, you know, revenue, whatever. Like you can just get more, you can just get a bigger number, or you can sort of, you can do an internal change. You can say, you know, oh, well, you can become satisfied in that sense. You know, like, you don't, you can say, oh, what I have is enough. My laptop is enough. My apartment is enough. My car is enough. Like, you can become satisfied. And that's a way, in one way, to be content with how much you have, and thus negating the requirement for wanting more in that sense, you know. Right. Now, that may be like unconvincing, because you do want to get paid for your work ultimately. You know, you have to, if you have a family, you have to feed them. Like, it would be irresponsible, or it would be the opposite of virtuous. It would be evil or immoral to subject your family to poverty because you just were like, oh, I'm a tortured artist and I want to make sculptures and whatever. You know, like, there's a realistic, pragmatic sense to it all. And then also, there's also like this understanding yourself in a true light. You know, you may say, I'm a tortured artist and I'm just, no one understands me, and that's why I'm not making any money. And like, that may be true, but it also may be that you suck at what you do and no one should like, watch, read, listen, et cetera, what you produce. You know, right. you may produce garbage. You may not be a good tortured artist. You may be a bad one, and you may not deserve, and you may not should take this as like a means of making your living. Does that mean you should stop creating? No, absolutely not. Everyone should create, you know, and everyone's going to suck at the beginning of what they do. And that's like, that's baked in. I've heard, like, Carl Jung talks about archetypes, and there's one called the Fool and the Savior. And he says the Fool is the pretense of the Savior. And so the Fool comes before the Savior. So that means you have to be ridiculous before you can be anything miraculous, you know? And so you may have to suck and not get paid for your work for a very long time until you hone your craft, you know? I don't, like, you might agree, and I would definitely agree, that no one should ever read or think about reading something I wrote when I was 18. And likewise, you may say, no one should ever read, watch, or look at something I produced when I was in high school or whatever. Right. Because what I wrote was fundamentally garbage. I wrote a piece on politics defending the idea that we should be able to abort up to 3 months after the child was born. I wrote that piece in freshman year of college. I wrote that children should be aborted up to 3 months after birth. That is the most absurd, mortifying, disgusting thing that, like, when I read it now, when I went and looked through my archives, I was like horrified. I was disgusted that I'd written something like that, you know? And like, should someone have read that back then? Maybe they should have read it so they could have said, you idiot, stop thinking this way. And maybe to that extent they should have read it, but should they have read it and been like, ah, yes, very good. I'm, you know, let's implement this policy. Absolutely not. Absolutely not. You know? And so, like, the fine line of accumulating wealth or like earning a living from your art, in some sense, it should just be natural. It shouldn't be like, you shouldn't, I think maybe the line is when you begin to alter your style so that you don't lose followers or money or, you know, whatever. I think so long as you maintain that sense of integrity, regardless of whether you have 50,000 followers, 10 million followers, or whatever that might be, so long as you maintain the integrity that you have, like, you don't change your commitment to your message, I think that no amount of money you earn creates a negative circumstance.
Right. Yeah. And that's something that's, you don't see, or that when you do see it, it's very respectable when people turn down, you know, deals with their company that will, that goes against, you know, their pyramid of virtues or whatever it is that the company stands for. And that's definitely an increasingly large issue, you know, cause like, what if I came to you right now and said, hey, Adam, like, if I paid you $1 million to write this piece on saying, you know, taking back your ideas and say that abortion is okay, would you write that for me, sort of thing? Like, obviously that's something that would be incredibly challenging for you. Like, you know, $1 million, like, dang, I can do so much with that. Like, just for the sake of you know, nudging on my morals a little bit, like, that, you know, it's easy for anyone to start to entertain that idea. So when someone denies that, like, it's, I respect it so much, because it's like, man, I don't know if I could even make that decision. Like, I'm glad I don't have to, but boy, like, you know, when someone turns down millions of dollars just for the sake of keeping their motives and their intentions pure, like it's a strong thing. And, you know, it shows even more strength to how much they care for what it is they're creating.
I mean, I totally agree. It's such an admirable thing. And you see it a lot, like in the music industry, people will turn down a record label because they don't want to sell themselves out, or YouTubers do that all the time. Most of them sell out though. YouTube is, is such a fickle place. Most people are there explicitly to make money off of what they're producing or whatever, and they'll sell out in a heartbeat, and that's like their goal, is to create content so that eventually they can sell out, which is very unfortunate.
Right. And you know, it's definitely a motive for a lot of people just going into YouTube of like, you know, just something to try to make a living off of. And you know, it's those people that are, you know, either advertising a product, or maybe it is streamers that, like, at the end of the day, they just want to sell themselves to make money. And you know, it's in some instances I would say, like, yeah, go for it. Like, if that's your motivation just to make money, then, like, you know, everyone has the right to do what they will with their content and their platform. But you know, it's only when you see the corruption of something that turn into that is when you can get a little disheartened by it. Is like when it's like, oh, you used to be like this, but you know, now you're like that, or you know, now you're pushing to appease the masses. So
right, just as someone turning down lots of money to keep their message true is admirable, the opposite of that, accepting millions of dollars to change your viewpoints and corrupt yourself is well, disgusting. No better word for it, really. It's one of those things that's the least admirable thing you can do. Mm-hmm. And one of the most upsetting things, especially if you liked that creator or valued that person's work. It's very hard to watch them throw it all away for some dollars and cents.
Right. Yeah. And this is happening all over, you know, with, you know, from the first sort of wave of movies, or sorry, books being turned into movies, like people get that feeling instantaneously. They're like, wow, this completely soils the movie or the book that I so dearly loved. And you know, I'm just completely disgusted that this movie was made in the first place. Like, it's sort of the same thing of like, man, I resonated with that and you took it from me.
Yeah. It is like, it's an insult. It's like a slap in the face, you know. It's right. It's so unfortunate. But well, did you have something? Or I think we've reached our hour, unless you had something else you wanted to add to that.
That was it as far as points I had. Do you have any other closing remarks or thoughts?
You know, nothing more that could really add, at least at this moment, to what we've said, other than like how unfortunate selling out is, the moral degradation of our society, and like, you know, that pursuit of virtue itself. Like, those are kind of the things that I guess should be at top of mind, at least right now. You know, more people are selling out. The moral road, walking with your right foot, has never been more difficult. Being virtuous has never been more difficult. Like, those things are things people should be looking out for and paying attention to.
Right. Yeah. I don't think it's going to be get any easier to dodge those things.
No, unfortunately, it's likely to only get more difficult. And maybe it's always been as difficult, but I just have a hard time believing, with their technological advances, that there hasn't at least been some extra degree of difficulty added to the temptation of evil, you know.
Right. Or any sort of restraint to, you know, that sort of the consumerism monster that's been developed now.
Right. All right. Well, all good stuff. Do you want to let people know where they can find your work again?
Yeah. Again, I'm Alex Braun, mostly on Instagram at xbraun, AXBRAUN, or online just at xbraun.com.
Awesome. Well, that's been great talking to you, and I'm sure we'll have future conversations. So,
yeah, thanks for having me, Adam. Really appreciate being on your show.
Excellent. Well, we'll see you in the next one then.
Yeah, see you next time.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to this episode of the Will Work for Purpose podcast. If you liked what you heard here, you can find the podcast wherever major podcasts are found, as well as YouTube. So you can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, YouTube, Stitcher, etc. Wherever you listen to your podcast, you can find this podcast. If you want to support the work that I'm doing, subscribing is a good way to help, or you can check out the merch store, and the link for that will be in the description below, and you can buy this sweatshirt that I've been wearing, which is the anti-nihilism or the anti-meaninglessness sweatshirt. So thanks for watching. Leave your impressions of the show in the comments below or wherever you happen to be listening to this. And if you want to be on the podcast yourself or want me to interview someone, you can contact me at mosley@tweakingo.com. And you can find the rest of my work at tweakingo.com. Again, thanks for listening, and I'll see you in the next one.